Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Hawkins versus the Aid Association. Mr. Lockridge?
Good morning, Your Honors. This arbitration provision is an adhesion contract of the crassest sort. When these policies were bought, some of them over a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago, the bylaws provided for judicial remedy. The purported amendment to the bylaws by AAL here swept away extensive substantive rights retroactively, as much as 14 to 15 years after the policies had been bought. Our client signed nothing. There was no agreement to anything regarding arbitration. And the teaching of the U.S. Supreme Court from the first options, and of course other cases, is that there must at least be some agreement to arbitrate. There must be consent. And indeed, the only notice, such as it was, that was even given was an extremely one-sided, ineffective announcement included in AAL's free magazine that they send out to all of the 1.7 million policyholders every month. And I should note that there was no suggestion ever when these people bought their policies that they were obligated to ever read this free magazine. The notice that they received in this magazine was contrary to the bylaws of AAL. Their own bylaws required the notice to be published in full, which did not happen for about one full year later in July of 2000 in the correspondent, and long after these suits had been filed. The initial mention of the arbitration agreement was in May-June 1999, just about 3 months before the first of these lawsuits were filed, when AAL said that it was instituting some new procedures to make dispute resolution better and enhance the resolution process. And enhance was their word. That, of course, was not the case from our perspective. In July and August, in the correspondent, there was a short, about 10 to 12 line summary of a few aspects of the arbitration provision, but it did not mention that there were no class actions, no compensatory damages, no punitives, no attorney's fees, even if successful, no way to recover transcript costs. Indeed, it said very, very little about the process.
What would happen if this notice had come out properly? What would be different?
Your Honor, I believe that the reality is that our plaintiffs had no choice whatsoever, and that
notice or no notice.
Notice or no notice, they had no choice. This was not like Gateway 2000, where you can just send the computer back. These people had these policies for many years. Many, many are older. Four of the seven named plaintiffs today are in their 70s, and some have become uninsurable. There are surrender penalties, higher premiums for new policies, and so forth. Nevertheless, I think that the notice issue is important for two reasons. First of all, I think it shows that there's absolutely no consent here. And second, I think that the notice argument is admittedly somewhat of a technical legal argument. They did not comply with their bylaws, but I think that that's one that we are entitled to make.
Does this reduce the benefits payable at all?
It does not, Your Honor. Does not. As I noted, even if there had been actual notice, and even if there had been an agreement to arbitrate, a consent to arbitrate, our plaintiffs had no choice but to hold on to their policies for the reasons I noted, also for potentially adverse tax consequences, higher premiums for new policies, and the fact that by now many of our clients are getting elderly. These clients basically are stuck with these policies. While they did not reduce the actual benefits, Your Honor, it is clear that any material amendment to the bylaws done subsequently must be, quote, reasonable, if you will, and that's the Whistler case from Wisconsin and the Stern case from Wisconsin. We submit that this was not a reasonable bylaw amendment. At the very least, this change in procedure should not have been done by bylaw changes. It should have been at least an addendum to an individual's policy. An individual should have received notice by first-class mail with the opportunity to say yes or no, or at the very least, a negative option of some sort. They had none of that here. None of the indicia of consent are present in this case. There's a recent case in the District of Minnesota, a federal district court, Addison v. Evers Connections, which we believe is pertinent, but obviously we believe the Waffle House case from the United States Supreme Court is on point, since it emphasizes that arbitration agreements must be a matter of consent. As far as substantive unconscionability, Your Honors, this arbitration provision does one thing. It takes away virtually every right that our plaintiffs would have had in court. Everything else, almost everything else, is totally one-sided. And the reality is that AAL knows full well that, of course, there will not be any or a very, very, very tiny number of...
Is there any language in the policy itself which gave them the leeway to do this?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first one.
Was there any language in the policy itself which gave the company the leeway to go to arbitration?
The only arguable language in the policy itself, Your Honor, is, and not in the application, which is signed by the people, but in the policy itself, there is a reference to the fact that the bylaws of AAL are incorporated by reference, as are all future and subsequent amendments. But there is no indication that these people are to read the correspondent magazine. They never saw a copy of the bylaws until after these lawsuits were filed. As I was noting initially, AAL is not required to arbitrate, but of course it can sue its own policyholders in court. We submit that this is unconscionable on its face when the party with all of the bargaining power completely exempts itself from the process. And this is a teaching in a part of a number of cases, but particularly the recent Circuit City decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the Circuit City decision on remand from the United States Supreme Court that was just issued in February of 2000. Under this arbitration provision, most significant remedies are eliminated. A plaintiff cannot receive injunctive relief, punitive damages. A plaintiff cannot receive any attorney's fees if successful. Plaintiffs cannot receive related costs, such as transcript costs. And I might note that the lack of injunctive relief we think is important, and we believe that's entirely different than specific performance. Specific performance, it's my understanding, is normally limited to the four corners of an agreement. And here we would perhaps seek injunctive relief, seeking that additional money be paid into a policy to bring it current, or injunction barring rescission and so forth. And I might note
they know the merits aren't really before us so much about the underlying problem, but as I understand it, there's some sort of churning and replacement of policies and taking cash value and buying new and cashing out and doing things that were cost more money, I guess.
That is correct. There are two underlying claims, Your Honor. One involves the so-called vanishing premium claims, which for many of the policyholders, it was represented to them that their premiums would end in, say, a set number of years, 6, 8, or 10, and then they did not, and it kept going on, and they had increases, and sometimes very significant increases in their premiums just at a time as they were getting older, contrary to the express representations. Secondly, as Your Honor mentioned, many, in fact, indeed all of the named plaintiffs had their policies churned. They had an existing policy, and the sales agent got them to take the cash value out of that and buy a new policy, which obviously leads to more upfront cost. It's what's wonderful for the insurance agent, the insurance company, but certainly not good for the insured. And indeed, some companies more recently have had entered into a strict policy barring, except in the most unusual circumstances, churning. Another provision, of course, that is eliminated is the right to a jury trial. While I fully appreciate that under Mary Kovaleski and other cases from this circuit and others, a party can knowingly, intelligently waive their right to a jury trial, we submit that was not done here for many of the reasons that I've already mentioned. As I noted, when they first bought their insurance, the plaintiffs could go into court and could have a jury trial. There is nothing in the two so-called notices in the correspondence at all about waiving your right to a jury trial, not a mention of the word jury or a trial. And of course, obviously, there's nothing signed here indicating that the people knew that they were waiving their right to a jury trial. And among the cases we rely on in our brief is the Erie Telecommunications case in the Third Circuit, and of course the United States Supreme Court case in D.H. Overmeyer from 1972. In addition, class-wide relief is prohibited. The United States Supreme Court has emphasized that public policy favors the use of class actions to redress widespread and unfair wrongdoing that affects numerous people. And here there are upwards of 1.7 million policyholders. The fact is that by making claimants proceed in arbitration individually and with no attorney's fees and no class action and no penalties and no recovery of any related costs, they know very well that virtually every single claim will go unredressed because no one going to be able to get an attorney, period. Taken together, we believe that all of these issues make the arbitration provision clearly unconscionable. Indeed, the unconscionable effect of the whole we submit is even greater than the sum of the separate unfair parts. The unfair and unreasonable factors, we believe, compound each other. I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Lockridge.
Thank you.
Mr. Landau.
May it please the court, the issue here is not whether plaintiffs can pursue their claims against AAL, but where. Plaintiffs want to pursue nationwide class actions in court. To do that, they first have to invalidate AAL's bylaw requiring binding arbitration of claims against AAL. In order to do that, they must obliterate the fundamental distinction, which is really critical in this case, between fraternal benefit societies like AAL and commercial insurance companies. At the heart of this appeal is plaintiff's assertion that, quote, in reality, AAL is simply another insurance company, unquote.
What's the big difference between this type of company and a commercial company?
Well, a fraternal has not only insurance, but it has a bond between the members. They join together to pursue a common goal and common interest. That's in the statute, it's required. And they have to be organized in lodges, which have to meet at least once monthly to do activities. They're not just there's not just a financial or commercial relationship between the insured and the company. And that's kind of the historical background of how these kind of organizations got formed.
Are the premiums cheaper than commercial?
Not generally, Your Honor. They're basically comparable in terms of the criteria. That's all the same. I mean, historically, these kind of organizations started when certain ethnic groups could not get insurance, and that, I think, accounts for, again, starting over 100 years ago, why this has been regulated differently. And you'll see every state, all the 50 states, have fraternal codes that are different than their commercial insurance code and reflect the difference in the organization. That has a couple of specific examples of how they're different that are really important to understand. One is the maintenance of solvency provision that all fraternals have to have that is very different than commercial insurance companies. When you have a commercial contract, that's a closed contract. That's the entire contract between you and the insurance company. When you have a contract with a fraternal, like all the contracts at issue here, the fraternal is not only authorized, but it's in fact required to have an open contract that reflects changes in the bylaws, so that those are incorporated in each and every contract, and I'm quoting the Wisconsin statute here, as if they had been enforced at the time, well actually when I'm saying quoting, I should look at the actual language, as if they had been enforced at the time of the application, is what the Wisconsin statute said. So again, that's the regulatory regime that recognizes this. And this maintenance of solvency is very important because a fraternal can go after its members to for an increase in premiums if the fraternal's assets are impaired. In other words, a commercial insurance company, they can't increase your premiums. Once you have a contract, that's it. A fraternal, again, recognizing the kind of fraternal and benevolent bond that unites these people, can go after, if there's if the assets are impaired, the fraternal has the obligation to go out and get increased premiums or to lower benefits. So a member of a fraternal does not have a specific, the same kind of guarantee as a member of a commercial, or a owner of a commercial insurance certificate.
What's the benefit?
Excuse me?
I don't see any benefit of doing this, unless you're uninsured or something like that.
A benefit of going into a fraternal? It's the idea of a common bond. That's very important to a lot of people, that they join this not only to get insurance, but they think, hey, I'm getting insurance. I'm also joining with a lot of people that I can relate to, and the charitable aspect is extremely important. They do, again, that they have to meet in lodges by state law, that's part of it, and they do incredible charitable works, disaster relief, community assistance projects. If Susie's child has leukemia, people get together and put money in the hat. And in a lot of communities, this is just kind of a way of life.
And so they expect to see the insurance premiums or the profit from it, whatever you want to call it, go into that sort of thing. I don't understand it all, but obviously you have a lot of common bond in people who want to form a class, too.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the one thing that's important to know is that fraternals are tax exempt under the federal tax laws. They're 501c8 organizations. And so therefore, what the fraternals basically do is they use the money that would otherwise go to federal taxes to do these kind of charitable projects. So a lot of people prefer to see their money going into that kind of to put to that kind of use.
Now they say that money went to insurance salesmen who churned the account. Did it go to the insurance salesman or did it go to the Benevolent Association?
Well, again, Your Honor, we are a non-profit organization, the fraternal. So any
salesmen are there for profit, I assume.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's right. We have salesmen and they have commissions, that's right. But their commissions are really like commissions of other insurance salesmen. So to that extent, that's a similarity. But again, the salesmen are members of our organization as well. And I think the key, again, is to keep in mind that there's this whole self-governance in a fraternal that you don't have in a commercial insurance company where, again, all the benefits go to the members in the sense that the members are the company. There's really no difference. All the members of the board of directors have to be members. And so what they're really doing here is that they're asking a court to second-guess the decision of the member elected and member constituted board of directors of the fraternal about what's the best way to guard against or to protect the fraternal as a whole. And a decision was made that it's in the interest of everybody in the fraternal to have a system in place for dispute resolution, not just for these kinds of cases, but in general, that is easy, it's efficient, it's quick compared to the judicial process. And a lot of their arguments are really undergirded with a hostility towards arbitration, as if arbitration is somehow doing something bad and that we pulled the fast one. But again, we are the members. We, our president, you know, and our board of directors decided that as part of their obligations to the membership as a whole, they thought that arbitration is the way to go to be resolving disputes. And again, so much of their argument really goes back to an attack on the open contract system. As you heard this morning, my opponent said that this was all terribly unfair because there was no assent, no consideration, no agreement. But there is a written agreement, which is their application for insurance and their signature on the contract, which itself, that contract specifically stated that the bylaws are part of the contract and that any changes in the bylaws would not reduce benefits, the benefits payable under the contract.
When they signed the contract, did they get a copy of the bylaws?
Yes, Your Honor, those are part of the contract. Now, and it says at that time, any changes to in the contract itself, which is in the appendix, specifically says it will not reduce, any changes to the bylaws will not reduce the benefits payable under the contract. And as you heard this morning, opposing counsel specifically conceded that that this is not a reduction in a benefit promised in the contract.
But it was an increase in the premium, he said.
I'm sorry?
He said there was an increase in the premiums or a continuation of premiums that would have otherwise ceased. So obviously you're paying more for the same benefit.
Well, Your Honor, their underlying claim says that they, is an allegation that they were promised that premiums would stop after a certain number of years and that they still had to pay. That's the underlying claim. The only issue here is whether the arbitration, that's really the issue that's going to be decided. We believe it should be decided in arbitration. The issue here is whether the bylaw amendment is itself a reduction in benefits. We contend that it's not. Now, one thing that's important just for us to clarify our position, because they, in their reply brief, misstated our position on this, there's really two separate things going on here. First is the whole open contracts issue, that we're allowed, under the open contract system that's required by all 50 states, to have these open contracts as long as we do not use them to reduce the benefits paid in the contract. So, in terms of the retroactive nature of their challenge, a lot of their challenge is based on the whole open contract system and the notion that it's retroactive, the notion that there's not a specific signature agreeing to the arbitration provision. But again, that really is all tied up in just the nature of a fraternal. Having said that, that the fraternal can do this kind of a retroactive change, it's still our position that you have general laws like unconscionability that apply. We do not take the position that any change whatsoever is permissible as long as it's not a reduction in benefits. We concede we cannot reduce benefits. That wasn't done here. But we concede.
Is there any case that supports that view, that going to arbitration has any impact on the benefits?
The Woodman case from the Supreme Court of Alabama specifically said that going to arbitration is not a benefit. It promised in the contract. And again, opposing counsel misspoke this morning. When he first got up, he said that the original contract provided for judicial remedies, he said, and involved substantive rights. But as Judge Clavert pointed out below, if you look at in the appendix at the original bylaw provision that they're referring to, that just provided a default statute of limitations period for any action. It didn't create a substantive right in the first instance. So again, I think it's no accident that they conceded this morning expressly in response to your question, Your Honor, that this case does not involve a reduction in benefits.
Mr. Lando, is continued membership in the fraternal organization a condition of insurability?
Your Honor, you have to be a member to purchase the policy. I believe the answer is yes, that the policies are for the members or the people that the members designate. There are people who have terminated, there are people, past policyholders, to which this would apply.
So they wouldn't get the notice then because they wouldn't get the magazine, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. None of the people at issue in this case are past members.
They're all current.
They're all current, Your Honor, yes. So that's not an issue presented here.
I'm just reflecting on what you stressed, and maybe appropriately so, the democratic nature of the organization, the electing of the board of directors.
Right.
But if you've lost that, that's why I was wondering if you could be insured but lost participation in the election process because you weren't a member, whether or not that created a different class of insured.
Your Honor, I suppose a different question is presented in the case that is brought by a former member who claims, I'm no longer a member, but I have a dispute about my contract.
Or maybe a beneficiary.
Well, the beneficiaries is different because the statutes in all the states say that they bind the members and beneficiaries. And it's clear that a beneficiary can't have greater rights than the member who signed the contract from whom the beneficiary is.
I just wonder if they'd have lesser. I mean, in other words, if you had a husband-wife situation where policy was taken out by... first of all, I should ask you, can a spouse be insured, the spouse of a member be insured?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you buy separate policies for the non-member spouse?
Yes, Your Honor. That you have to be a Lutheran to purchase the policy, but you can buy a policy for a spouse of a Lutheran, and the Lutheran can purchase a policy for himself or herself.
I'm just wondering what the standing, if any, is there a unique standing for the non-member insured in how that, as I say, impacts, well, either notice or the issue of the uniqueness of being in a fraternal insurance scheme.
Right. I think in terms of notice, it is true that beneficiaries do not receive notice. But again, I think in the law in general, your contacts are with the primary person.
Well, let's say we have a Lutheran male married to a non-Lutheran female, and they both take out policies.
Correct.
And for whatever reason, maybe the death of the Lutheran male, and that policy is paid out or whatever. But the other policy continues, I would assume.
Yes, just to clarify, the non-Lutheran spouse would not be able to purchase that policy.
Only
directly.
To be a beneficiary?
Yes, because only the people who are Lutherans are allowed to purchase the policies, or with certain exceptions, if you work for the Lutheran Church or if you're sponsored in a particular way. But if you look at the application form that's in the record, you can see that you have to check off that you're a Lutheran or have that. If I could just address a few points that opposing counsel made. In terms of publication, he referenced that he said that the requirement in the bylaws was publication in full, and that's not correct, Your Honors. It just says the word publish. He inserted the words in full, and I think as Judge Mannion, as you noticed, in a sense, the notice provision is ultimately not something they could have done anything about anyway. Even if they had noticed, they wouldn't have been able to opt out. It really is, as he conceded himself, a technicality, and we believe, for the reasons we stated in our briefs, that there was full compliance, or at the very least, as the district court found, substantial compliance with the bylaws, and certainly the remedy would not be complete.
I'll have to ask you to conclude.
All right. Well, for those reasons, Your Honor, we would, again, just respectfully ask you to affirm the judgment below.
Right. Thank you. Ms. Lockridge?
You know, with all due respect to my esteemed colleague, Your Honor, who are they kidding here? This is a Fortune 500 company. Of course the boards of directors are our members. This is just like every other publicly held corporation in America. But an individual policyholder doesn't have any more say in that corporation than a person who owns 100 shares of IBM or anything else does. 100 years ago, it might have been appropriate to say that certain ethnic groups could not get insurance and so forth, but that is certainly...
So we should make a distinction because the fraternal group is larger by a 10 factor now or a 100 factor. I mean, how should that impact our interpretation of the bylaws or...
Well, I think
what license do we have to do that? I guess
right. Frankly, I don't necessarily think it does. I think that 50 years ago, the way they went about amending the bylaws would have been entirely inappropriate, completely inappropriate here. And if actually, if there was such a bond here with the people as they claim there is, why didn't they tell the people up front about this bylaw amendment? They did not do that. This went under the radar screen. And I also wanted to correct counsel. I am certain, and I know that the record reflects, that when you receive your policy, you do not get a copy of the bylaws. I suppose you could ask for a copy of it, but you do not receive a copy of the bylaws.
Is the bylaws relating to the policy or the fraternal organization?
The bylaws relate to the, I'm speaking of the bylaws relating to the fraternal, to the organization itself, Your Honor. I believe Your Honor asked...
Well, would you get that upon becoming a member?
I don't...
Whether or not you opted to participate in the insurance program.
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor, but the only reason to become a member of AAL is to buy insurance. I mean, everything is insurance, and insurance may have mutual funds and so forth. And I should note out, while of course they have charitable activities like all corporations do, the real reason they engage in these charitable activities is because the IRS requires them to do that to maintain their tax-exempt status. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lockridge. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will